everyone. Welcome to Authors on the Air. I'm your host, Pam Stack. We're proud to be part of the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network. Tonight, a terrific guy comes back to the show, one of the nicest writers that I've ever had the pleasure of meeting. T. Jefferson Parker has been here before. It's been a couple of years since we last spoke, but every year I can count on reading a book from Jeff Parker that's going to blow me away, and this year is no different. C.J. Box had this to say about Jeff Parker. T. Jefferson Parker is the poet of American crime fiction, and The Room of White Fire absolutely proves why. It's topical, poignant, brutal, tragic, and wry at the same time. And the tale humps along with a rhythmic and stylistic soundtrack of a beating heart that seems to be shared by P.I. Rollin Ford and Parker himself. So there's a damn good reason T.J. Parker has won 3 Edgar Awards. I'm proud to present my friend, Jeff Parker. Hi, Jeff. Welcome back.
Hi, Pam. Nice to be here.
I loved it that Chuck said that about you. Because it's true. And this book is just really, I can't remember being thrilled by a book the way I was with this one. It is riveting. The tension level is so high on this, and it's just amazing. For listeners who've not read The Room of White Fire, you'll excuse me if I pretend like I don't know you, but tell me, is Rollin Ford a new character for you?
Yeah, Rollin Ford he's the PI, private investigator, and the first-person storyteller of The Room of White Fire. He tells us the whole tale from A to Z, and he's a brand-new character that I invented just to do this job. I'm intending to write a series of books based on Rollin Ford's adventures, and so he's my new hero, and he's going to carry us into one adventure after another if all goes as planned. And in The Room of White Fire, I kind of wanted to begin the book a little conventionally. I wanted the readers to be comfortable with the first few pages and kind of go, oh yeah, I know stories like this. And so first few pages, Rollin, who's a PI, he's hired to find a troubled young man who has escaped from a high-end mental institution, and complications ensue. And soon the reader will find that he's not in really a conventional whodunit and PI story at all, but in something very, very intense and very historically relevant to us who live here in this world in 2017.
It is a fascinating character study of both men, by the way. It really is. Do you have Rollin Ford, your PI, your main character, do you have him fully fleshed out in your own mind?
Yeah, good question. I don't, kind of on purpose, though, Pam, because, like I said, I want to write a series with this guy. I've always wanted to write a PI book, and PIs, you can write a series about a PI. And so when it came time to write this very first book that he's in, I was very conscious and deliberate about trying to create a character that my readers would like, who I would like enough to write book after book through, and who would have, a big enough kind of portfolio and history to shoulder the burden of an adventurous crime story, year after year after year. So, I went in consciously trying to make Rollin do those things, and one of the things that I knew I wanted to do was to be able to go into Roland's past. And so a lot of Rollin, what makes Rollin Rollin, has been hinted at in this first book, and a lot of it has been flat out ignored, because I intend to go back over time and kind of fill in those blanks. So I know Rollin well enough to put him in the here and now, but I don't know him well enough to write, for instance, the next book. And part of the process, the journey of writing that next book about him, will be discovering more about him, if that makes sense.
It does. It sounds like you're kind of peeling the onion to get to the heart of who Rollin is. And I like that, because as a reader, I want to learn more. And the more you show us about him in each subsequent book, I think it keeps it very interesting. Makes me want to know more and more and more. And you're right. You can do so many things with a private investigator. Yeah. It isn't like he has to just go and he's not locating just missing vets or anything like that. The surface is wide open for you to go ahead and play with, correct?
Yeah, that's one of the things I love about the PIs. You know, I've always, ever since I was a kid, I was a fan. You know, the TV PIs and the movies.
Yes.
And, you know, literature. Yes. It's just it's a wonderful individual because you know, he's, PIs are kind of above the law and kind of the law, but above the law a little bit in the same way. You know, there's a little bit of. There's a little bit of the ne'er-do-well in most PIs, you know, and they're not bound by a strict code of behavior, if you will. And so I love the idea that a PI can stretch the rules a little bit and has to rely on his own cleverness and resourcefulness, her own cleverness, resourcefulness to get by, because, you know, the great big thing that the PI doesn't have is a bureaucracy behind them. You know, they're not organization men at all. And I really like that about Roland. And he talks more than once in the Room of White Fire about how he wishes that he were still a sheriff's deputy for San Diego County, because he could call on all the personnel and technology and bureaucracy and weaponry and whatever it might be, all these resources that the cops have that Roland no longer has. So he sees what he could do as a cop, and now he can't do it because he's not carrying a badge.
But conversely, he can do more than a lot of cops on an individual basis. So it's a nice dichotomy
kind of
that you set up there.
Yeah, to ad-lib a little. Yeah.
Absolutely. And I think that's what gives this character so much spark. It's a fascinating, fascinating book. I am particularly fond of this title, The Room of White Fire. And when I posted about it, I said, is this not a great title? And everyone was saying, yes, it's a magnificent name for a book. Will you share how the title came about, please?
That's funny. I'll tell you. I hope it's not a disappointment, but I'll tell you. I wrote the book, the draft, the book that you read, and in that book, White Fire, the phrase White Fire means a couple of different things. Mainly and most simply and most clearly for the reader, White Fire is CIA code name for a black site prison in Romania, okay? And I wrote the book. And White Fire is the code name, and that's explained in the book. It's no mystery. And then White Fire,
right.
the phrase takes on another meaning within that context of the black site, which is a little darker. But basically, that's it. And so when I turned the manuscript in to my agent, I said, well, Robert, here's the manuscript, and welcome to White Fire. And he read it, and he goes, well, Jefferson, I love this manuscript. I love this story. But I think we should call it The Room of White Fire. And I
said, did you like the
you
title?
Know something? That sounds really good. So my agent invented the title. Yeah.
Well, kudos to your agent. It is it's a very eye-catching cover and title. So,
yeah, it is. It is.
Yeah, it's really amazing. Is this your first series, Jeff?
No, this is my third series, kind of technically. First series was three books back in the 90s. Right. Featuring a woman named Mercy Rayborn, who was a sheriff's department detective, homicide detective.
Yep.
And that went three books, so I guess that's a trilogy more than a series. And then recently, in 2008 through 13, I wrote a six-part, six-book series based on a character named Charlie Hood, who was a sheriff's deputy attached to an ATF task force. So he's kind of a fed, a deputized fed, if you will. And that was a six-part series. That ran for 6 years, and then after that, I felt that Charlie was done, and his time on stage was sufficient, and I went on and did some other things, and I wrote two standalone novels, 2015 and 16, and then here for 2017, I began the series, and the next book in the series, of course, as series will do, the next book will be out almost exactly a year from August. It'll be out next August, about a year from the time The Room of White Fire came out. And it's almost
And
gone.
That one is Swift Vengeance, or at least that's the working title right now, correct?
Yeah, that's the official title. They're working on a cover now. It's called Swift Vengeance, and it's a continuation of the Roland Ford saga. Completely different story. You know, some of the characters remain the same. His irregulars, the people who rent his little casitas from him, kind of repeat
right.
a little bit. But basically, I'm on to a whole new story.
I like the fact, though, that you keep these ancillary characters around. It's continuity with the story. But there is a question. You, since you've written other series characters, you have to remember what you said about the little nuances, maybe the renters of the casitas, because I bet you anything you'll get an email from someone who says, wait a minute, that's not what you said last time in the last book.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah.
Do you keep a Bible for your series characters?
You know, I kind of do. It's a little bit spread out, and it's a little bit piecemeal, but yeah, I do. I have birthdays, birth dates literally written down, you know, year, month, and day. You know, physical stuff, it's not so hard. I remember that pretty well, but like, you know, births and when you're, how old they are. And, you know, as each book comes out, you know, a year from the last one, you're faced with the task of aging everybody who's in the book, you know, accurately as possible. Otherwise you're going to look silly and people are totally going to catch it. And so, yeah, I do have a Bible going, and one of the things that I've learned after doing this for 30 years, I've written what, 23 books now, 23 books in print. One of the things I've learned is to as soon as a new character walks on stage, stop, give him or her a birthday, and month and year, and keep track of that somewhere so that you're not constantly flipping back. You know, like a year later, if this character comes back, and go, well, how old is she? Is she 23 or 24? You know, well, big deal.
Right,
so,
right.
You got to do that. Got to have all that biographical data more or less straight. You know.
So I'm good. So you're aging your character in real time, I think. Maybe you're not, but it sounds like you are. However, you know, writers like Sue Grafton have never aged their characters, and yet her books are beloved. How do you feel about that?
Well, that's a great question. I had to answer that question when I began the second book, when I began Swift Vengeance, and you know, I actually was on book tour just about a month or two ago, talking about this book around the country, and I was polling my audiences occasionally. I would say, would you rather read a book in which would you like to see Roland Ford aged a year, you know, per book as the books come out yearly, or would you rather see him sort of kept around the same age and kind of preserved? and most of the people, it's about 70-30, but most of the people preferred a character who ages roughly a year, roughly in real time, like you said. And my gut instinct on the whole question at the beginning was that that was what I wanted to do. So I think I'm going to age him a year each time now. He's 38 when The Room of White Fire opens, much younger than I am. And I wanted to give him enough years, 38, to have experienced much in life, but enough, not so many years that he is, you know, compromised by age in any way, and that he's still essentially in his, you know, mental, physical, psychological prime. So I think if I were to age, you know, Roland, you know, 10 years, I think I could still, you know, 15 years even, I think I would still have a capable and believable and a reliable private investigator on my hands, and that's what I want.
Now, speaking of, do you have a number of books in mind for Roland, or will you just write until you say, okay, I'm ready to start something new? How does
that
work?
That's what I do, the latter, yeah. Yeah, I'm not much of a planner ahead. Or, you know, some of my author friends are frighteningly competent at that. You know, they'll be two, three, four stories out, and they're collecting, you know, evidence and, you know, information and making notes and collecting stuff for, you know, stories way, way out in advance. And I just kind of look at them jealously and go, God, I wish I could do that. But I can't, and I quit trying years ago. So when I finish a book, you know, when I really bring a book finished, when the copy edit's done and I can look at that thing and it's out of my hands, literally, you know, I will have been, by that point, making notes and fishing around and daydreaming and checking my clip files and reading my newspaper assiduously and just kind of, you know, sending all my radar and my antenna out as best I can, because I know that I need to come up with another story. And typically when I finish a book, I really genuinely have no idea what the next book's going to be about.
Really?
Except that when you write a series, which is cool, Pam, I know one. I know my hero, Roland Ford, duh. I know where he lives. I know what job he's got. I know who his neighbors are. I know what his family life is like a little bit. You know, I know enough. And so I do have a place to start, at least.
Fascinating to me. How much research did you have to do to write a PI story? And he seems... very like a very real character to me. So, you know, yes, it's fiction, and yes, there was this horrible, you know, black ops thing going on behind the scenes and all, but do you have to research quite a bit on this, Jeff, to get it right, or is it kind of you're letting fiction take over?
You know, this was a research-heavy book for me. I've done them that are research-heavy and some are not. But because this book is based so much on real events and things that happened during our war against terror in the past few years, there's not just tons of information about it, but you as a writer owe it to your readers to kind of pull that all that together and shake it down and make some sort of narrative sense out of it, some sort of dramatic sense out of it, if you will. And in a way, you know, the Room of White Fire is simply that. It's trying to put a face on some very dark years and some very dark events in our recent history, and it's my attempt to turn that murky, scary world into bright and moving drama.
Well, you succeeded. I have to say that it's a brilliantly written book, and I'm surprised that we don't know what Roland's going to be doing in Swift Vengeance. How soon? You are still writing Swift Vengeance, so you've already got your storyline there, and I'm just going to ask for one teaser. Is it so different from this book, this storyline?
Well, I'll tell you what it's about. Roland's good friend, Lindsay Rakes, from the first book, the drone pilot,
right.
Retired Air Force woman, has received what appears to be a credible death threat, and it's rather terrifying, and she takes it right to Roland, and she says, "Should I be worried?" And he says, "Yes," and the story goes on from there.
Oh, so it's totally different. I love that.
Yeah.
But you do have a heavy military influence. That is a theme that is very close to your heart, though, isn't it?
It is, and it wasn't always. You know, recently it has become that. I don't come from a military family. My father was in the Air Force, though, served honorably, Korea. But you know, as a writer, my first probably, you know, 20 books, I mentioned various wars and things that we were, you know, involved in as a country. But I think it was around 2010, maybe, after I had lived here in Fallbrook for 10 years and lived right next door, literally, to Camp Pendleton, Marine Base. And I started getting to know those guys. I would see them all around town because, the Pendleton guys would come into town to shop and get gas, and I'd see them, you know, at the Albertsons or the local, you know, the bar or whatever. And I started talking to these young Marines, and I became, you know, so impressed and so intrigued and so moved by what these young men and women had been through and what they were going to do, you know, if they were about to be deployed. About 2010, I realized I couldn't not write about these men and women more directly and still feel that I was being a relevant American writer. So that's what I did. I've written about Marines and Air Force and Army soldiers for four or five straight books now, not exclusively military stories, as you know. These are not combat tales at all. They all take place in America, but Roland's he's a veteran, served well for First Fallujah. And many of my other, several of my other protagonists lately have been veterans, and I really do feel genuinely that, you know, our war on terror, if you want to just say that generally, since you know 9/11, I think those wars are the biggest story of our time, and I feel like I have a front row seat to that. In that I live near Pendleton and have gotten to know some of these people, and I feel that it's my duty as a writer to make sure that they are justly and sufficiently represented in my books, because the world's full of people who have gone over there and fought and come back, and we need to know their stories.
When we talked last time, and it's been a couple of years because we spoke when Full Measure was out, you mention that you occasionally go over there and you do writing classes with some of the soldiers. Is that true?
Yeah. Yeah.
And are
I
you
do.
Still doing that?
Yeah. Whenever they ask me, it's been a little while, but they'll ask me again. I'm friends with a librarian out there on Pendleton, and there's three nice little libraries there. People might not realize, but you know, so many Marines live there and their families. It's just a huge, huge base. And so there's three libraries, and they bring me over there every year, every other year, and gather together a group of Marines who may be interested in writing, you know, writing about their experiences. And so I always, you know, just sit down with them and tell them a little bit about who I am and what I've done and, you know, about, you know, my writing. And I always try to tell them what I just told you. I think that their stories are the most important story that our country is involved in right now. And I think that it's not going to be people like me who are going to be able to tell those stories in all their, you know, ferocious detail and heartfeltedness. It's them. And I task them to do that, and I ask them to do that, and I beg them to do that. And whenever I get a piece of writing back from one of them that has quality, I go straight to my agent with it, and I say, read this and see what we can do for this guy. So, yeah, I believe in those stories, and I believe in those men and women a lot. And, you know, in just some, you know, some kind of cornball way, it's just me giving back. You know, I never served. I was number 351 in the lottery during Vietnam, so I wasn't going to go. I didn't have to go. I didn't want to go. And I didn't sign up when, you know, the Twin Towers were doomed. I was bombed. I was too old. And so anyway, it's just my tiny little way of offering something back to people who have given a whole heck of a lot more than I have.
You know, Jeff, this is why I say you're one of the nicest men I've ever met in the writing community. It's such a nice thing that you're doing. But I think that you get a lot out of it, too, probably more even than your soldiers do. And I know you enjoy doing it, and I honor you for that. It's an amazing thing.
Thank you.
What's
I like
next
doing
for
it.
You? What's you're finishing up Swift Vengeance. I can't wait. You know, I'll be excited to read that. Do you take a break between books?
Yeah, I do, and that break is usually spent pulling my hair out trying to think what the next one's going to be about. So, I'm doing plenty of hair pulling. I have a few patches of hair left, but doing that, and I get to sneak away. You know, Chuck Box and I went fishing, you know, together a couple weeks ago, and I got another little trip in last week up to the Sierras to do some more fishing, and I kind of mope around, and I take little kind of personal trips. My wife and I, you know, go places and stuff, but always in the back of my mind, I'm kind of, you know, wringing my hands and thinking, wow, what's that? When am I going to find that next story, you know?
Hold on, and let's take a call. Hi, you're live. Who's this?
This is Matt.
Hey, Matt.
Hey, Matt.
So
hey,
you know who you're talking to. You gentlemen know each other. Matt Coyle, Jeff Parker, say hi.
Hey, Matt.
Oh, is Jeff Parker? Oh, I thought it was T. Jefferson Parker. I'm not even sure who I'm talking to.
So that changes your question completely, I'm sure.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I have one question, then I'll get off the air. And I don't think I asked you that when I had you on my show. Did you ever think about bringing Joe from Silent Joe back?
Yeah, I thought about it a lot, Matt. I love that character, and he's so unique and so different, and he was so young. I mean, you know, if I picked him up, you know, 12 years later or however long it's been, I'm sure he's had a long and a very interesting life. I may do that, you know. I don't know if I could shoehorn him into a Roland Ford book or not, but yeah, I've got some love in my heart for that character, Joe Trona, and I wouldn't mind writing him again at some point. Yeah.
There are a lot of us that have love in our heart for Joe. Anyway,
that is a really
good
book, too.
And you got another 23 more books at least, so you can fit them in somewhere.
Yeah, hopefully.
Well, let me ask you both, since you both write crime. Matt, have you ever thought about writing – well, you've written one character. You are still in your series. But do you think you'd ever do a crossover book where your characters would meet if down the road a ways you're finished writing Rick Cahill?
What characters? You mean?
When you finish writing Rick Cahill, and I don't know if you have plans to do that or plans to do a standalone, but how do you would that be of interest to readers? Do you think to have a crossover character from one series visiting a character in another series? Do you think you'd ever do that?
Well, depends. Depends who's publishing me, I guess.
There you go.
Anyway. Anyway, that's
what
it's
about,
not about me.
You?
I called in for one question, so I appreciate.
Well, I'm glad you did.
I'm enjoying the talk, as always, and
thanks,
I will
Matt.
Listen off air.
Talk to you later.
Hey, good.
Thank
good
you.
Hearing from you, Matt.
Thanks.
Thank you.
You bet.
Okay.
So, is that something you would consider doing? I mean, it brings up an interesting point. You have a standalone book, and it's a beloved character. Do you think you could find a place for him in a Roland Ford book?
Well, I don't know. I suppose you could elbow him in somehow, you know. I don't see why not. There's no reason why you can't. I always thought that when authors did that, it was kind of corny, and I didn't really care for it myself. I thought it was kind of clubby. But, you know, if it's done right, fine. And, if my readers, stood up and, on masse and said, we demand, we want to hear from Silent Joe again.
Right.
My publisher goes, oh, God, we listen to all this noise there. They're gonna burn the castle down if you don't bring Silent Joe in. I'd find a way, but, I don't know.
Sure.
It's hard enough to write a novel that makes any sort of, sort of credible sense these days without dragging fictional characters back from your own past. I don't know. I don't know.
It
gives me the willies a little bit. I'm not sure.
Well, before I let you go, and I'm really enjoying this conversation, and I wish that we could stay on for a long time, but I'm not going to take your time. When you look back at your first book, and now you fast forward to book number 24 that you're writing right now, what's changed with you and in your story writing?
God, yeah, what a question. You know, a lot has changed. 23 books is a lot of books, and
yeah.
I think for me, and all of my books are in the same kind of genre, if you will. Even the couple of standalone sort of literary books I did are very kind of criminally based, if you will, crime based. So all of my books are sort of similar in genre, if you will. They're all crime stories, but I think what's changed for me is which is what I love about being one of the many things I love about being a writer is I think that you can actually get better being a writer into old age, and I intend to prove it, and I don't have to prove it. Just look at John Le Carré. I mean,
right.
I think I'm a better writer than I was then. I think my storytelling is much more nimble and adept and light on its feet in the sense that I don't have to tell the reader over and over and over again what to feel and how to read this text. I feel like I'm good enough now that I can get my point across subtly and quickly and economically in a way that when I was young, I felt like I had to kind of pound the heavy bag much more than I probably really had to. And young writers do that. You overwrite.
Sure.
And that's easy. Everybody overwrites, but young writers overwrite more. And so one of my, quests over the years has been to try to, be more economical.
Trust your reader.
More concise.
Yeah, you gotta trust my reader.
Right. I don't like leading my reader around by the nose. I just don't believe in that. So,
as a reader, I want to tell you that when someone is like almost putting little, text bubbles over the character's head and telling, explaining things, it's a visual that I have in some books. It's very frustrating because it's almost you're writing down to your reader, and readers by their nature are generally smarter than a lot of other people because they read.
Yeah.
So it's a very frustrating thing. I think a lot of first time writers, as you say, do that, make that mistake. Very frustrating.
Yeah.
I'll put a book down. I have the luxury and the blessing of the gods to get more books than I'll ever be able to read. And so I've become so selective, on what I'm reading. If the first page they're talking down to me, I'm not interested. It's it's a waste of time. I don't even give them a chance after that. And that's really sad because, it makes me not want to read a follow-up book too.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
It is what it is. So here's the final question. Are you still nervous when your book releases the same way you were when you first started? Are you always asking yourself, God, I wonder if they're going to like it? or I hope they like it. Are these things that go through your head, even as a seasoned, best-selling, and multiple award-winning author like you, do you still get nervous?
Yeah, sure I do. Sure I do. I'm always on
really?
On pins and needles when a book comes out. You know, I've had predominantly, you know, good to really, really good reviews in my life, but I've also been butchered a few times, and I know exactly how it feels. And in this day of kind of instant, you know, internet of opinionizing and stuff, thumbs up and thumbs down and all, I mean, you get a really fast, you know, democratic reading vote on your book, you know, just by going on the Amazon site and reading the reviews. So, I'm always nervous. I'm always worried. And luckily, I mean, the good thing about a book tour and doing promotions and lots of interviews and stuff around Pub Date is that you don't really have time to read all the reviews, and you just kind of go and you do your thing and you go to your stores and you, you know, give your little presentations and readings and stuff. And by the time the dust settles a month later, you know, all the reviews are in, and you can read them at your leisure or not. So, yeah, I'm always nervous and I'm always worried. But I've learned over the years not to obsess about all that too much, you know, because I do know, I think, you know, how much control I have over what readers believe about me. And all of that control that I have over my readers is spent by the time the book comes out, you know. I mean, I've done as good a job as I can.
Sure.
I wrote the book as well as I can, as hard as I could, gave it my best. And, you know, after that, it's just kind of, well, it's out of my hands.
There you go. If I ask you to come back and guest host a show, who would you want to interview?
Who would I want to interview on your show?
Yeah.
God, the list goes on and on. How about Don Winslow?
I wish that Don would come on. I wish he would. Shane will not allow him on the show for some reason.
Yeah.
He just is really, his time is so tied up. I would love Don Winslow. If I could get Don Winslow, he's yours, okay?
Okay, you got
You'll come on and be the guest host. Will you do that?
You should do it. You're the one with the good questions. You ought to interview him.
Yeah, well, you know, but this is those special programs like that are called In Conversation, and I love having two authors speaking to each other. So I'm going to send you an email to remind you of that, and you're going to give me a couple names, and then maybe you'll come back when you finish up the with your edits and all, and you'll take a slot behind the microphone. It'd be fun to have you.
Well, that's a thought. I will consider that.
Thank you. T. Jefferson Parker, the new book is The Room of White Fire. It is absolutely amazing. Go and get it now. You won't be disappointed. This is the start of a new series and a new series character, Roland Ford. You're going to love him. Jeff, thank you so much for being with me. It has been a pleasure, as always, speaking to you. And I hope you have a delightful weekend.
Well, thank you, Pam. Pleasure's been all mine.
Thank you so much. Have a good evening. Bye. And that's our show for tonight, folks. I want to thank you for being with me. I want to remind you that support for this broadcast is provided by the Authors on the Air Press, new release, Betrayed, Powerful Stories of Kick-Ass Crime Survivors. You can get it anywhere where ebooks are sold. Thanks for being with me, and thank you, Mom and Dad. Good night.